I think the one thing about the comic book, for me at least, is it's one vision. And I think that always is a problem. I worked in advertising for a while, and it was sort of the same idea. Too many cooks in the kitchen, whatever cliche you want to use. But the fact that I'm one person doing everything, whether or not it's the greatest thing in the world isn't the question. Is have I achieved what I set out to do? Like, whatever story I had in my head, did it come out? That's sort of how I think about it.
Do you feel continually let down by modern media? Do you miss the good old days, back when all that mattered was a good story and not some agenda? Do you have ambitions of picking up a pen and pad and fighting the creative war yourself? Then this is the podcast for you. Each week, I'm going to talk to a creator who said enough is enough and started making the content they wished was out there. Join us as we discuss the ups and downs of the self-publishing world. We want to help empower you to join the Iron Age of media. Welcome to Iron Age Marketing. Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Iron Age Marketing. I am Nikki P. here, as always. My guest today is Fabrizio Aiello. Why don't you tell us who you are and introduce everybody?
Yeah, thanks for having me. My name is Fabrizio. I'm a comic book creator. I create Horace H. Hoover. So I write, draw, ink, color, letter, and worry over Horace H. Hoover. It's a sort of a 1920s occult detective, and it kind of pulls from pulp, a little bit of horror, a little bit of, I mean, maybe a little Mr. Bean or Douglas Adams kind of stuff. And he sort of travels all these pocket universes and solves mysteries, whether it's supernatural, occult. Right now, it's currently a 5-issue miniseries, and I'm working on issue 4 right now. So that's what I do 24/7. My day job is I'm a programmer, so you know the comic book thing comes next.
So your goal was, let's try and get out of this field that's going to be taken over by AI and into another one that doesn't make any money.
That's exactly my thought. Yeah. I'm like, well, if the software thing doesn't work out, I'll have this other job taken over by AI. Why not? Next thing I'll go into is fast food or something where robots will take over. I don't know.
Right on. Well, How did you find your way here? We were talking a little bit before this, and you know, you sound like me. You're not natively a superheroes guy, and superheroes are what people think of when they think of comic books. But I've never been one of those people. I like the weird stuff that you could get away with storytelling wise in comics for years.
Yeah, I like to pull from not just comics, so. Yeah, even though I did read superhero comics growing up, you know, as soon as things like Sin City or Hellboy or The Goon, you know, as soon as that stuff kind of came out, it allowed me to kind of refocus. I'm like, oh, you know what? Maybe I can do comics, even though I'm not into superheroes. So once that sort of opened up the field, you know, I pulled from movies, literature, like just aesthetically all the things that I like and kind of crammed it into the book. But I have nothing against superheroes. Again, I grew up on them. You know, the storytelling I still appreciate. So the narrative storytelling, the visual storytelling. So I use that part of it, you know, the Claremont stuff, the Kirby stuff. And then I sort of put it in a different context with more horror, sort of occult stuff.
Okay. And so like, let's get to the real pitch here. The fundamental of this. Describe for my audience the hero of Horace H. Hoover.
Sure. So Horace H. Hoover wears something that looks suspiciously like a vacuum cleaner on his head. And, you know, to describe his character, he is optimistic, positive. He's very vocal about everything he's thinking at any given time. He really just takes things as they come. So whether it's a ghost or a dragon or a world devouring monster, he's going to kind of look at it just as a problem to solve. So he's kind of like a mix between, we'll say, Sherlock Holmes and Inspector Clouseau or something like that.
Okay. Well, I like you bring up the word hope, because, you know, one of the big criticisms that we have of like the modern comic book is that like the nihilism that kind of started creeping in the 80s just kind of took over everything. And certainly the stuff that makes it to TV and movies at this point is all very dark. It's very nihilistic in what it is. So I know there is certainly an audience for people that have been looking for comic books to be something where you can find hopeful heroes again. Now, is that something that you just did on purpose or something you said, you know, look, I know that the market's looking for this, so we need to make sure that happens.
So I think, I mean, it was definitely organic, but as far as the market that really wants the dark nihilistic stuff, I'm not going to lie. I gravitated towards that at a certain point, you know, whether it was The Killing Joke or, you know, something like Watchmen, anything by Alan Moore, really, except for his later stuff like Tom Strong or something like that. But yeah, you just kind of get mired in and you want something different. You want something more hopeful. And since I'm doing every aspect of the book and the character, you kind of live with that. So if you're doing this really dark, nihilistic story and you're doing every part of it, you sort of have to live with it all day, every day. And I didn't really want to. I tell this story. So I'm a game developer and I came up with this game years ago. Really dark story. I was really excited about the gameplay and the mechanics and even the story, but it was so dark that after a couple of months, I shelved it just because it was so dark and I had to like really, I didn't want to think about it all day long. So, you know, eventually Horrors came along, the character kind of popped into my head. I'm doing these sketches and it just emerged, but it wasn't a specific thing like, okay, the market is headed this way. I'm going to go that way, you know, either contrarian or kind of go along with it.
Just happened to be where everybody else was at the time. Like this is kind of, well, I can definitely vouch for anyone who thinks that like, oh, there's no such thing as too much horror. I am a horror guy. I've been a horror guy my whole life. If you look back there, there's entire shelves of just horror movies. A couple of years ago, friends of mine said, hey, we're going to do this thing. We're going to do 100 Nights of Horror. And so it started in July. I ended up doing 105 nights of horror movies. And I will tell you, psychologically, it messes you up. Like you're just it, what goes in definitely affects you. So I do every year. I'll do 31 nights and like I'll do like little short videos for them of reviewing the movies I watch and put them up on YouTube. But I just there's no input that's good for a person.
That's impressive. I mean, 105 nights. Like, how long did it take afterwards to sort of like get back to like normal where you weren't imagining? Like,
it was a couple months. I mean, it wasn't like I was imagining things. What it is just, there's a general unease that you just get when you're mired in it. And as much as I love the stuff, I would never tell anyone to not be in it because it's been so formative for me growing up, but you got to understand like a time and a place, and you really do need to have other emotions out there.
Yeah, I feel like that way with music. I listen to a lot of like metal or hardcore and sometimes I'm like, you know what, I'm going to pop in The Cure. And then 5 minutes later, I'm like, that was a bad idea. I should not be listening to The Cure. That's coming out, you know? So yeah, like you said, whatever goes in, it definitely kind of like adjust you and your mentality and your mood to some degree. Horror is a whole extreme sort of thing though.
Well, it's funny because it's like I even made it like a point. I'm like, okay, well, there's no way I can do all like, you know, put in as much horror comedy as I can to kind of to balance some of like the emotion. But like I mean, even in the horror comedy stuff, we're still watching people get dismembered a lot. So it's like, it's still just graphic stuff that your brain doesn't necessarily know how to deal with entirely.
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, as far as comics, I don't know. I always felt like comics were my safe place to look at horror, because I'm not a big horror guy. The movies are kind of hard for me to watch. Some I like, some I don't. It's weird for me. Sometimes some things bother me. But oh, you know what? Comic books, I can kind of look at anything if it's in a comic book format. So I do like horror in comic books, but as soon as it gets on the screen and it's a little too real, it's just a different animal, I think.
Oh, absolutely. I grew up listening to Clive Barker. That's my guy. And so he got me into it. But even today, like, I don't know, maybe it's just getting old. I got kids of my own and stuff now. So it's just tougher to take the stuff. Like, you know, what I could do when I was 15 and like, oh, this is all just BS. Like, yeah, I've seen a few things in life now that it's maybe not as ridiculous. Some of the stuff.
When I was real young, well, not really young, like in high school, I remember I went to a party. And at the time, Faces of Death was really popular. I don't know if you're familiar with that.
I remember Faces of Death.
And I walked in, unbeknownst to me, in the middle of it. And I'm scarred after that. Some things just, it affects you.
So you mentioned that you're a game developer by trade. I'm curious, what have you noticed as far as the industry goes from games to comics?
As far as the games that I do, it's nothing fun. It's nothing that anybody would play. It's sort of these big companies need
things. Your boss hates you right now.
these big companies need stuff for trade shows. So like mini games, like cutting edge, maybe AR, VR to get them into these booths. So it's nothing comparable to like modern games, but I will say this. The reason I got into games, so I've been programming for a very long time, but games were exciting at a certain point for me. I saw them as an avenue, like a new avenue for writing and music and really what I consider to be art. I know there's always that conversation, are games art, you know, back and forth, but I played a few games that I really consider like art or as good as some novels I read, no doubt.
I was going to say, is that even a question anymore? Some of the games out there, the writing that goes into them is probably some of the best storytelling that's going on in like mass media at this point.
Yeah, because it really was this sort of brain drain where, you know, there's all this money in games and people are like, well, I'm a writer, might as well do it in games, make money and be part of, you know, BioShock, wherever the case may be. Admittedly, though, I kind of backed off. I feel like it turned more into the MMORPG stuff. So the stories were a little more, they weren't directed. And I never got into that as much, like open world stuff. It felt more like mini stories than like I said, a narrative. And that's just my personal, I'm not a big game guy. So.
Well, I would imagine it would feel to me almost more like you're doing like a, that's what I'm looking for here. It feel almost like reality TV at that point in the storytelling, where it's just kind of everything's micro stories. It's not. Don't get me wrong. As much as I rail constantly on the show about, I want my freak of the week shows, like and screw your grand arc, your grand narrative. But the bottom line is like the grand narrative needs to be present. It just can't be everything.
Yeah, there has to be something there for sure. That's why like some of the games that I look back on fondly had a really directed narrative and were cohesive. And yeah, there were little mini subplots here or there. But at the end, I felt like I had just read a great novel. And to me, that's really satisfying. And I feel like games, and again, I don't play very many anymore, so I could be wrong in saying this, but they definitely veered off in a different direction. So I probably haven't played a modern game in quite some time.
Well, I grew up very poor. So like the last game system I had was like the original PlayStation. I've downloaded a thing or two for my daughter on Steam these days, but I've never been like a games guy, but there've definitely been like games that came out where I made it a point to go and like watch like a playthrough or watch like, you know, compilation of the cutscenes to kind of get the grand narrative. I can't remember what was Bioshock Infinite was the one that I just absolutely loved. A friend of mine's like, you got to check this out, and that story is just wild.
It's incredible, truly incredible. I hold that up as like one of my favorite stories just across the board. It's amazing. And the art, everything about it was just on such a level that I don't know if it's been matched. Again, I'm not that familiar with games out there, but I feel like that it was a high point.
So I guess going maybe a little bit more in like your background, what kind of upbringing led you to this place, like games and comic books and stuff like that?
Yeah, you know, I'm endlessly like self-analyzing as to why I like things. I don't, maybe that's not fruitful. I don't know, but I wonder that myself. I love the Transformers, and I ask myself, why do I like the Transformers? What is it about Optimus Prime that still, when I see Optimus Prime all these years later, it there's something about it. I have put quite a bit of,
I mean, in general, it's just it's interesting when people go into the arts and like pursue that at all. Like that, I'm a lifelong musician, and it's just something that breaks in a person that makes them willing to deal with that kind of nonsense.
Yeah, I was gonna say I blame, like, I'm also a musician and an artist, so something is really wrong with me. But I think if I kind of go back in time, there's a few things that really stick out. One is music, like album covers and the imagery and that just mystery of that. And I think that led me down. And to me, it's two sides of the same coin, because these album covers, you know, their paintings and drawings and these beautiful pieces of artwork, you know, and then that kind of led me into the artwork to some to doing art to some degree. And as far as what kind of art, I think, sure, those album covers, you know, those old rock and metal album covers. I grew up Catholic, so being surrounded by a lot of that kind of imagery, I think absolutely informs.
That's a grand narrative for you there.
Yeah. You know, when you're sitting in church and you're looking at the stained glass windows and people being, you know, crucified, it's just that imagery really sticks with you, I think.
Well, I had a friend who went over to Spain, like, in, like, one of his early years in college. And when he was over there, like, spent some time in, like, the old cathedrals. Like, here in America, the one thing that we don't really have is a sense of history in the way that, like, European nations do. And the thing that like he reiterated to me that he got most when he was over there is like, you understand why the church controlled everything for so long, because you're in these giant stone buildings. And like you said, you're looking at these giant windows, these stories, they're like all this iconography. And it's like, it's psychologically impacting on you as you're there. And then there's, you know, hundreds of years of history of this. So it's no, definitely, I could see how like that would definitely be affecting.
Yeah. And I mean, I went to school for fine art, so, you know, that takes a lot of either stupidity or gumption. I don't know what the word is, what old man word there is for that, but.
Well, you just know you're getting out and you're going to be a graphic designer, right?
Yeah.
Well, that was why I didn't go to fine arts.
I mean, that's what I kind of, I'm like, well, I'll fall back. I'll do this or this or whatever. I didn't think programming would be one of them, because I didn't even, you know, understand it at that time. But I just couldn't fathom doing anything else. And I know a lot of people say the same thing. You know, they can't imagine doing anything else, so they just do X.
Well, and kind of going back, it's interesting that you mentioned like the albums, because God, like I remember like opening my Bush razor blade suitcase for the first time and like just pouring through the liner notes, and like you put the album on and you kind of walk through whatever this piece is. You know, Christmas Day like was always just this weird I'm just going to get all my new CDs I got and go through, pour over the artwork, listen to the tracks. And that experience is something that I know didn't exist before. Like, I was younger, that didn't exist until the 70s and was kind of over by the 2000s. But I feel like that was so formative to so many people, just going through that process. I hate that my daughter will never get to go through that. I mean, the physical media thing in general, if we would have connected to something that opening up a DVD or, just looking in the $5 bin at Walmart and seeing just the dumbest looking cover ever, going, come on, I got to waste a Saturday night on that. And the adventure that you'd go on with that.
Yeah. And I think you're either a person that loves mystery and is just endlessly curious to find out what is inside this thing. You know, what story is illustrating this crazy album cover I'm looking at, or whatever the case may be. Or you're just somebody that it really doesn't catch your interest. And it's like, oh, that's a cool piece of artwork. But then there's people that just stare at it. And I don't know what the difference is between us and other people, though. And it's something I think about endlessly.
Well, maybe the problem is that they've, opened the DVD case and it's all too often been nothing but trouble. they waste a Saturday night on that one.
I understand that.
And no amount of digital underground is going to save that. So yeah. Now I'm curious, you've gone through what was your first cycle of crowdfunding in comics, or are you just doing a storefront? What has been your mode to kind of enter things?
So I was with a publisher for the first two issues, and it was a crowdfunder. I left the publisher, and I had a decision to make. Is it crowdfunding? That's the standard, especially since I'm not bringing a name, Do I do the store or do the crowdfunder? And I went back and forth. And the reason for this time I went with the store is simply because I wanted to get the book in people's hands as quick as possible. And to me, that felt like that was the quickest way to do this. Find a printer, get the proofs, get them printed. I'll pay for everything up front. I'll get the books. And then as soon as somebody orders a book, they get it, in 3 or 4 days. That doesn't mean I won't do crowdfunding in the future, but this was an interesting sort of experiment. I kind of had fun. I still did a launch day. So I didn't put too much marketing towards it, but I'm like, I'll present it like people would for a crowdfunder. I'll do a stream, invite people on, explain everything.
Well, I mean, there's psychological reasons to do all of that. It's if nothing else, hypes up the sense of urgency in it also makes people want to be a part of something. Like there's an event, there's those things all work on the psyche to kind of make them push the button.
Yeah, I think people being part of an event, I think that's 80% of crowdfunding. Well, I don't want to put a percentage of it, but it's a big part of crowdfunding. First, once you realize it's not about you selling, so you can make enough money to get the books, it's really about people being part of something. They feel like they're part of printing and part of getting this book done and out there for other people to enjoy. So.
Well, I remember years ago I read, it was a guerrilla marketing book for musicians. And one of the big things that it tried to get you to think is that you can't, and maybe it was different at a different time, but certainly when I was coming up and playing music, you couldn't think of your gig as just a gig. Because if you think of it as just a gig, then everybody else is going to think of it as a gig. Everything had to be an event in and of itself. There has to be a reason they're going to spend their very precious time on you. You have to make this a thing that people want to be a part of. And if you approach marketing, you approach everything from the idea of we're trying to create something for people to be a part of, you're going to last a lot longer certainly than someone, oh, this is just the next thing I'm shitting out.
Yeah, it just shows how much value you put on your product and how you treat it. So like you said, if you don't value it, nobody else is going to look at it as it has value. I remember I was hearing Kiss's first show was in some tiny dive in New York City, but they did the whole thing, all the makeup, like everything. They drove there in a limo, you know, it probably cost them way more money to do that show, but they treated it like, you know, like they valued it. And I think that's key.
Gene is a terrible human being, but like his, you know, if you've read anything with him talking about the band and like the business side of the band, like there was never a chance of that band not making it because he was going to do whatever it took for that band to make it. I mean, and it's always funny because a lot of people like don't realize even like what he was going for. Cause with all the makeup and everything, like there's you almost get like a cartoonish feel about the band when his goals were nothing short of being the next Beatles. Like that he wanted to be the biggest band in the world. And you know, that's, I always laugh about anyone getting compared to the Beatles. Like it's funny, like Muse, I always feel really bad for because they're never even going to be the biggest band in their hometown. you guys, I'm sorry, you're from Liverpool. No one will ever be more famous than another band from Liverpool.
Just move. You should have moved first and then.
Yeah, really. So now you're obviously in the programming side of, you know, gaming, but are there things that you noticed from that world that transfer over to like the stuff that you watch your bosses probably mess up when you go, I know I'm not going to do that when I release my comic book.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. They're so different. The worlds just, I don't know. I think the one thing about the comic book for me, at least, is it's one vision. And I think that always is a problem. I worked in advertising for a while and it was sort of the same idea. Too many cooks in the kitchen, whatever cliche you want to use. But the fact that I'm one person doing everything, whether or not it's the greatest thing in the world isn't the question. Is have I achieved what I set out to do? Like whatever story I had in my head, did it come out? That's sort of how I think about it. I'll let people judge after that. But to me, that's really all I think about when I'm writing, drawing, inking, color. I'm like, is this particular thing I had in my head coming out in the form that I want it to? And if I had, and I did have people push back on that, and in the end, you have to produce what you imagine, and you really can't let somebody else dictate certain things to you. Now, that doesn't mean you don't take criticism. It doesn't mean you don't collaborate. I'm not saying any of that stuff, but there are some core things about your story that you just have to be true to, because I think ultimately people see sincerity. And they can really sniff out, you know, if you're pandering or doing something, you know, just to.
Well, I mean, that's why all of our major corporations in the U.S. are like just dive bombing, because they've been, you know, lying to people for far too long and people are starting to notice. Like I taught myself as a post corporate marketer, because there's no ability to have authenticity in the corporate level anymore. Because you kind of pushed on this, I'm curious. One of the things that I've always been jealous of as a musician with the rappers, it's beautiful when you can have like that single vision, but it's also really nice to have a whole bunch of other people that have helped you on a project when it comes to telling people about your project and getting eyes on it. It's like I think metal bands started doing it for a while, where like they're bringing in like a lead guitar player from every other band that they're friends with, just so that like they could get them to promote one of the tracks on the record. It's like hip hop guys, they've been doing it for years. Like, oh, we just pull in a guy, and so we got 15 people shilling our album because they're all on it. It is way better than just me and my two buddies that were in the band trying to shill the album on it.
Yeah, I think it depends on the product. I think for Horace H. Hoover in particular, I know, like going into it, I knew it was going to be a unique project. So I have other ideas, other titles I want to do that are, I'm not going to say they're not unique, but this was a really unique vision, and I knew I had to get this out sort of in precisely the way it needed to be done. So if I brought people on, I think it would have been watered down, or there would have been too much sort of conflict to get that done. In the future, though, man, like, you know, having alternate covers from other artists, you know, which is the same as having like featuring somebody on a song, having, you know, guest colors, letters. I do think that it works out, you know, in the long run. Collaboration can sometimes be, you know, better than one person doing everything, because we can't be amazing at everything.
Out of curiosity, you do black and white or color books? Color? Okay. What kind of color is it? Are we doing like old school color, or are we doing like a modern, you know, flashy, shining light everywhere and everything's a weird fucking gradient?
It's definitely old school. So I took the old, I think a 70s palette, and I just limited myself to that color palette. So I started the book 2018, maybe 2019. And honestly, all I knew was I'm going to try a couple different styles, see what works, and then that'll sort of be the process I use in the future. Now, I'm older to the point where me Bronze Age is sort of the ideal. That's to this day, that's the stuff visually that I like. It's clear. I like the colors. I like the line work. So I gravitated towards Bronze Age simplicity for some things. So, well, I'll try that with the colors. And to me, it worked. It worked for a few reasons. It worked for the character and it worked for the story. I think if you apply that modern gradient, you know, bloom effect thing everywhere, I don't think it would work for Horace H. Hoover.
Yeah, like Horace H. Hoover's not going to work as like a 90s image comic.
No, and I mean, I don't want to disparage the 90s, but...
So you're not thinking to yourself, man, how cool this look if Rob Liefeld did it.
No, and I do always feel bad whenever I say stuff about the 90s and Image, because some people, that was their first books. So I know they have an attachment to it. So I try not to be negative, but it is like, that's when I jumped off of comics. When that stuff started to hit, it didn't make any sense to me. You know, by the time we got deep into the Image stuff, the art, the story, nothing made sense to me at all.
I think Image makes up 70% of my current pull list still. So.
The current Image?
Yeah, well, either Image or what do you call it there? Flyer, whatever it is there.
Skybound?
Skybound, that imprint I like stuff on.
Yeah, recently I have been picking up new books. So I feel like things have shifted back or in a good direction.
I like Spawn a lot. So since they've been expanding the Spawn universe, like there's been interesting stuff there. Big, big Gunslinger Spawn fan. Just the aesthetic of that's cool.
I think out of all of those books, Spawn was probably my favorite. And I think even though McFarlane's art, again, didn't make sense, it still had a cool factor to it.
Well, I think that's always been part of the thing, is that like he kind of threw out a lot of the rules and said, hey, if it looks cool, it's what I'm going to do. Like they're, if you ever look at, he's particularly known for like his Spider-Man webs that don't make any sense whatsoever. Like none of that makes any sense if you're like webs thinking, but man, did it look cool.
Yeah. And I mean, that takes a lot of guts to do that. He wasn't drawing that long before he really pushed it forward.
I watched a documentary on him and he's just an interesting guy. His story of itself. So what do you think, what do you want people to get when you've got your documentary about you as a comic book creator, you know, 20 years down the road? What's the cliff notes to that? What's the trailer going to look like?
I mean, I definitely am a more broadly schooled artist that just happened to do comics. So I do 3D modeling and sculpture. You know, I did a lot of illustration, painting. So I do a lot of different disciplines. And then I feel like whenever I decided to focus on comics, I'm bringing that sensibility and some of that stuff into the comics. So I just feel like it has a different look than I'm not trying to copy Mignola or McFarlane or anybody. Like, as much as I love Buscema and I wish I could copy him, I can't help but bring all of that other old stuff into it. You know, my really detailed pen and ink illustration. And so
I think when, as an artist, you approach things, you can't help but just bring what you're going to bring to the table. Like, it's maybe there's guys out there that like are workhorses, like Jim Lee or something. They can do whatever they want to do because they're almost like unaffected by the work. It's just a job. But like, not everybody, I guess, has that sort of approach to it. So, well, I want to thank you so much for coming on today, boss. It's been a great conversation. And I hope, you know, people go out there, look at the comic. I know I'm definitely going to be buying it because it's absolutely right up my alley. And I'll make sure they sit right next to my Wolf and Batsy collection.
Awesome. Thank you. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Where can we send people to check out what you do?
Yeah, so the main website is horacehoover.com, and that's all Horace Hoover stuff. So news, interviews, there's a store where you can buy the issues, digital and print, and just sign up to my Substack for the latest information. But the other big thing I have is a YouTube channel. So I do once a week on Sundays at 3 o'clock, I do a live ink or draw stream, which is a lot of fun. So if you want to get a hold of me, if you have any questions about drawing or art or anything at all, that's a good place to catch me.
Awesome. Well, thanks everyone for stopping out, and thank you, Fabrizio, for being my guest today.
Thank you.
Do you fancy yourself the next Tolkien, Lewis, or Barker? Maybe you just have something subversive to say. Hopefully this podcast is helping you. But maybe your ambitions are just a little bigger than you can handle on your own. Head over to ironagemarketing.com and let Nikki P. help ensure your book doesn't release to nobody.